From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hello from Washington, D.C., and welcome to Washington Watch. My name is Joseph Backholm, and I am sitting in for Tony today with you. Great show ahead for you today on the program. National Public Radio has been facing a crisis of credibility for a while, with concerns that it is simply another outlet for left-wing spin, before a longtime employee made a statement expressing similar concerns. Now, that employee is a former employee. What happened? We'll tell you about it coming up. Also, the California Attorney General has changed a ballot title on a state initiative for the purpose of prejudicing the public against it. And that's a shocking story. We'll give you the details of later in the program. Also, while the Biden administration is attempting to eradicate the difference between men and women in Title IX, which was created to protect women, high school students in West Virginia are taking a stand that could be the solution to the problem. We'll tell you what they did. But now for our headlines. Anti-Israel protests on college campuses continue to escalate as violence and chaos erupted overnight at institutions including Yale, MIT, New York University, the University of Michigan, and UC Berkeley. While school administrators seek to de-escalate tensions, many are asking if these chaotic scenes are a symptom of the environment they've created. And given the billions in tax dollars that flow to these institutions, how is Congress responding, or are they? Joining me to help us answer these questions is Congressman Ron Estes. He, among other things, serves on the House Committee on Education and Workforce. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Kansas. Congressman Estes, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Joseph. It's good to be on.
Well, tell us your reaction to the escalating tensions and anti-Semitic rhetoric that we're hearing on college campuses throughout the country.
Yeah, it really is appalling to see what's happened. You know, almost immediately after October 7th, you saw a lot of protests starting against Israelis and Israel, and that almost immediately turned into attacks on Jewish and turned into anti-Semitic comments and death threats and harassments. And we've seen it most commonly displayed on university campuses that are supposed to be environments where people learn. And instead, this just intolerance has been created there and created a culture of harassment and intimidation. And the university professors aren't doing anything about it. I mean, and the administrators, they actually, in some cases, either seem to support or actually give very tepid responses, if they do give a response at all. And it's not addressing the problem. I mean, we see so much anti-Semitic activity around there, and we need to focus on making sure that human beings are treated properly and not being addressed and attacked and criticized and having death threats just because of their religion.
Congressman, why do you think college campuses have become the epicenter for these? First, they were just kind of pro-Palestinian, then they became anti-Israeli, and now they are increasingly just anti-Semitic events.
And, you know, I think it's driven off of there's just so much, quote-unquote, free money coming from government funding of these universities. And whether they're a private institution or whether they're a public institution, you see a lot of federal dollars in the case of state institutions. You also see state money, like you see in Berkeley and others. But so much money that flows through that provides this cushy lifestyle. And so you see the administrators and the professors that really have no wherewithal to deliver anything of value because they're not focusing on how to provide a good education. Instead, they're focusing on their political beliefs and their political posturing. And what they've done is they've taken young men and women who are trying to learn what's going on in the world and what they should focus on, and are distorting their views of the world. And it's one of these things we're seeing it over and over again, with just the cost of education so expensive. You see that today. And we need to make sure that we're providing a good quality education and that administrators and professors are held responsible to actually provide that administration at a reasonable cost.
And there are so many dynamics at play here. You mentioned the rising, now incredible, cost of higher education in many cases. We're talking at the elite university, something like $90,000 a year as a starting sticker price. Yet we see these campuses becoming increasingly radicalized. And you also mentioned the fact that a lot of government money, even to private institutions, ends up at these institutions. Is there a role for Congress to play in dealing with the activity that we're seeing on these campuses?
There really is. As a member of the Education and Workforce Committee, I mean, we have the responsibility to provide oversight on funding that comes from the federal government. And for the most part, the federal government plays a more active role in actually providing dollars for not just K through 12 education that the state and local governments choose, but also higher education. And so much of the money that comes out of the federal government goes to those higher education universities. And obviously, college costs are expensive. And I'm a supporter of a piece of legislation that we have moving through the House right now, College Cost Reduction Act, because we've seen, actually, you can almost see a parallel path of, as government funding has increased since the 70s, you've seen this rapidly rising cost of higher education. And now we're suffering the consequences of that.
Well, and that really is a function of economics 101. You know, higher education costs go up as that's subsidized. To my understanding, the only other industry, sector of the economy in which that's happening is healthcare, where costs are also essentially guaranteed by the government. And so it should be no one's surprise that there's not really any reason, there's no incentive to reduce costs when the government's essentially guaranteeing payment. So we do see costs rise. From your seat on the Education Committee there in the House, any reason to think that reform is on the way? Is there an effort to look at higher education in a way that's different so that perhaps fewer children will be radicalized, but also it will become just less expensive and more accessible?
I think it's going to take a major effort on the part of the American people to stand up and voice the concerns that we're seeing over and over again in more recent years. And it's going to take a long period of time. I mean, this didn't happen overnight. America, typically allows things to fester and get to a very critical state before we actually start to react back. And this has grown since the 1960s and 70s. And so we've got to focus on, let's make sure that we have higher education universities that focus on providing good education. We want to have the educated workforce that actually move force and help with our economy. But we need to make sure that it provides good services and work. So it's going to take a long period of time, and there's a lot of inadequate thought process that's going into leadership of these universities right now, and it's going to take time for them to realize that the mistakes they've been making and that we need to correct that moving forward. Yeah.
Do you see any evidence that the market is adjusting? And by that, I mean, are families and prospective students starting to make different choices as a function of the ideology that they see on these campuses and also just the costs that are making it inaccessible to most Americans?
Yeah, I think you are. You're seeing that more and more. And just this year, the Department of Education, which has gotten large and bloated for being a very part-time function, but the Federal Department of Education couldn't even get the financial aid system FAFSA working in time to provide students. So you got a lot of parents that are anxious and worried about their students. You see case after case where people are making different choices. You see the enrollment, the applications have dropped at some of these Ivy League schools in particular, but you see it in a lot of universities as well. And you're seeing people making the conscious choice that maybe that's not the right decision for me. Maybe that's not the right career path I want. Maybe that's not where I'm interested in. And in the meantime, people are going out and finding good paying jobs as plumbers and mechanics and electronic technicians. And they don't necessarily have to go spend as much money on a four-year degree when they can actually have a career that actually provides them a good living wage and that be able to grow and provide their family for that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. As the father of now a and soon several college-age students, the ROI just isn't there for so many degree programs, and families, I think, are going to be forced to kind of reconsider what their options are, and that will make a market adjustment. But, Congressman, I want to switch topics slightly. Despite getting swatted down by the Supreme Court already, the Biden administration announced another round of student loan bailouts. Now, you serve, again, on the House Education Committee. Should Congress be involved in a student loan bailout program?
It really should. And President Biden is trying to do a runaround. In fact, what he's literally doing is violating what the Supreme Court has ruled. You know, it's an election year, so President Biden's pandering to get more votes, just like he did 2 years ago, and tried to propose this. He's calling it a bailout, but in reality, he's transferring debt that individuals chose to take on themselves, and he's trying to claim that we should give that to other taxpayers and make them pay back for that debt, whether they had student loans at all, or whether they paid their own student loans off, or whether they borrowed money to start their own business, expected to pay back the student loan from this offer that President Biden is trying to make. And again, it's an election year gimmick. The Supreme Court said he couldn't do that under the laws of the land. And so instead of following what the Supreme Court ordered him to do, he shuffled a few paragraphs around and tried to do it again. And this is going to get turned down again, just like it has before. He doesn't have the authority to waive all these debts and to transfer that cost on to other taxpayers. And, you know, that's the purview of Congress and the legislative branch to write up laws that need to be followed by the executive branch.
Well, you mentioned there the political motivation for President Biden in doing so in an election year. And, of course, student loan debt forgiveness stands to benefit more significantly younger voters. Increasingly, there are older voters who continue to hold on to student debt, but it's primarily younger voters. And data that I've seen recently that I think was relevant is that this younger voter demographic is also the demographic that has indicated they are less likely to vote for President Biden because of the U.S. government's official support for Israel in this conflict. So is this a situation where he's responding to the trouble that the Middle East and the Israel conflict is causing his political campaign with younger voters by saying, hey, but here's some money?
Yeah, you're really seeing these things seem to be coming together. I mean, President Biden's been very weak on the opposition and calling out the anti-Semitism that we've seen on college campuses. And so he's trying to shore up his support by offering a pandering to folks that are normal supporters of his. And you know, literally, when we get back and look at it, it's less than 13% of the American people that have student loans. And so what he's trying to do is cater to their vote. Yeah. and offset some of the issues that aren't being addressed and resolved by the college administrators when they should be leading in terms of making sure that the laws are followed on their campuses.
Now, Congressman Esteson, about 30 seconds. What's your advice for parents of students and students on campus who are just kind of trying to deal with what their college campus might be going through right now?
Yeah, I think parents need to be very introspective, and their children need to be very introspective on where they want to go, what they want for a career, and not necessarily jump into what sounds like a nice university to go to, but be thoughtful in terms of how they do that. And also be cautious. Lots of universities are not doing the right things. There are others that are doing the right things and need to focus on that. So you need to keep that in mind and making sure that you have a safe environment to have that good learning experience that you want.
Congressman Ron Estes, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Coming up next, a whistleblower inside NPR is no longer inside NPR. We'll tell you more about it when we come back here on Washington Watch.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Last week, National Public Radio CEO Catherine Marr became the center of headlines when social media posts and presentations she'd given emerged, which included expressing regret that the First Amendment prevents government censorship of, quote, misinformation on social media. Now, these comments came as NPR found itself also wrapped up in headlines surrounding their former journalist, Yuri Berliner, who publicly called out the news organization's left-wing bias. Here with his reporting on the drama surrounding NPR is Ben Johnson, senior reporter and editor at The Washington Stand. Ben, good to see you today.
Good to be with you, Joseph.
Well, let's first start off with Yuri Berliner, one-time NPR employee, longtime NPR employee, no longer with the organization. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, he wrote an expose in something called The Free Press, which is headed by Barry Weiss, former New York Times reporter, where he talked about the overwhelming liberal bias of NPR. He said that this had been something that had just taken place essentially in the last few years since the advent of Donald Trump, and that he found increasingly that he was on the outs if he wanted to try and present a balanced story. After he published this, he was suspended for 5 days, and then when the head of NPR issued an email, he ended up ultimately resigning because he realized there would be no hope of returning journalistic ethics to NPR.
So with respect to NPR's response to Yuri Berliner's allegations, did they say that he's wrong about that or that they just didn't like him pointing it out?
They didn't deny what he had to say, which would be impossible, essentially, given their track record, and particularly given the comments that Moore herself has made at various times. So instead, they simply shot the messenger.
Well, I referred in the opener to comments from Marr from the past that she was concerned about the freedoms protected by the First Amendment and how the First Amendment allowed, quote unquote, misinformation to be propagated around the internet. Are you surprised that she's concerned about what the First Amendment allows?
Ordinarily, journalists are quite concerned about what the First Amendment allows, generally in the idea that we should be maximizing our use of the First Amendment by publishing things, for example, that the government does not want heard. That's the true definition of journalism. Someone once said that anything that you're publishing the government wants published is simply you acting as a press agent. It's when you publish inconvenient truths that you're really acting as a journalist. But the idea that the First Amendment somehow constrains journalism or is a break on government, that's sort of a new concern. Of course, these comments were made while she was executive director of the Wikipedia Foundation. There's no indication that she has changed since she is now head of the NPR. If anything, she's doubling down on the idea that, quote unquote, misinformation has no place on NPR. But who determines what's misinformation? As we've done multiple stories at the Washington Stand, for example, on fact checkers either getting it wrong or blatantly bringing narrative in as a condition of misinformation. The facts themselves should out, but they don't always, particularly when it comes to NPR coverage.
And that is, of course, the choice that our founders made. The First Amendment does allow people to say things that might not be true, that people might not like, that we might be offended by. But they had determined that the risk of a public square where people are free to say what they wish are smaller than the risk of a society where a government gets to determine for itself and for everyone else what is true and false and therefore what can be said. And clearly, she seems to be in disagreement with our founders, but I think significantly, she's not the only person on the left to have said something like this lately. Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's on our Supreme Court, recently said during oral arguments that she was concerned that the First Amendment restrained the government's ability to protect people from misinformation, a very similar sentiment. But it's even more concerning when somebody on the Supreme Court expresses concern about the fact that the First Amendment restrains the government, when in fact the First Amendment was created for the explicit purpose of restraining the government from protecting our civil liberties. But Ben, how big of an issue is the fact that NPR is saying these things while being funded by taxpayer dollars to just be on the air?
Well, it's not even so much the fact that they're saying these things, it's that these things are in fact policy at NPR, and they filter down into the stories that people hear every day and that we're compelled to pay for with our tax dollars. Now, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting received more than $500 million last year, $525 million to be specific. Of that, about $119 million went to NPR either through station affiliates or through programming. And NPR, by the way, always says that the federal government provides a small percentage of its budget. That's sort of like when Planned Parenthood says abortion is only 3% of its services. There are a lot of accounting tricks that are going on there. In many cases, federal dollars go into other entities that then fund NPR. So it makes up a vast share of NPR's dollars. But then that impacts what ends up going out over the air. Of course, there are sort of highly woke stories about, for example, transgender individuals being involved in sort of Second Amendment training and militia activities. One of these went on the air not that long before the Nashville shooting. So these are the kinds of stories that they often focus on. But there is a massive left-wing bias, even an anti-Christian bias, quite candidly, in much of their reporting. And it's not even just their reporting. For example, they have a fairly comedic show called Wait, Wait, and Don't Tell Me. The host of that show in 2014 made fun of the crucifixion. There was an ad campaign showing a woman taking a selfie with Jesus, and she said the host said that Jesus couldn't take the selfie because his hands were occupied. So mocking the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The renowned NPR journalist Mara Liasson compared Antifa rioters to U.S. veterans storming Omaha Beach on D-Day. Morning Edition reporter Rachel Martin in 2018 referred to the quote-unquote so-called March for Life, although she later apologized. And these things really became official policy. In 2019, NPR had an official guidance reminder that no one should ever use the phrase the unborn because, and this is a quote from the guidance, babies are not babies until they're born.
Ben, in about 20 seconds, is funding, government funding for NPR, something that we should expect to continue in perpetuity despite all of this?
It's something that never should have begun in the first place. There is no constitutional authorization for a government-sponsored news service. The founding fathers never envisioned anything like that. And thankfully, there's a bill to defund NPR that's just been introduced by Representative Bob Good of Virginia. He's following the footsteps of the late Greek conservative giant Congressman Phil Crane of Illinois, who regularly introduced bills to defund CPB back in the 1990s. So a lot of this is going forward, and I think that we can see we're going to defund NPR in the
I've got to cut you off. We are out of time, but thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, the Attorney General in California has done something unprecedented in an attempt to stop a parents' rights measure. We'll tell you about it.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Lila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold, or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Joseph Backholm, sitting in for Tony today. Protect Kids California, a group of concerned California parents, has launched a ballot initiative for common sense policies that promote children's well-being. Now, these include school transparency to notify parents if a student wants to socially transition, protecting women's sports in private spaces, and protecting children from gender procedures, including sterilization and mutilization. These fell under the umbrella of a ballot initiative called the Protect Kids California Act. But California Attorney General Rob Bonta renamed this initiative, quote, Restrict Rights of Transgender Youth, end quote. And yesterday, a California state judge sided with the attorney general and his description of the initiative, which will now appear on the ballot. Joining me now to discuss this is Jonathan Zacherson, a member of the executive team at Protect Kids California and a member of the Roseville City School Board. Jonathan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you think the judge got it wrong. Tell us why.
Yeah, the judge got it wrong completely. We had submitted evidence that the judge denied. The attorney general had submitted evidence that supported our case that the judge denied, that showed that the word restricts is biased and can that a single word can have and limit the outcome of a particular ballot measure if it's going to succeed or not. On top of that, he included language in the summary that just makes up information about our measure, which said that our measure did not have any exception for student safety, when in fact that does exist in the law, and we had no changes to that. So we are disappointed in the outcome and look forward to options of how we can address this in the future.
Now, to make sure people understand exactly what happened here, when you file a ballot initiative, you file it with the state, and as a result of that, you also have to, when you file it with the state, one of the things that they evaluate is the title of the ballot measure itself. And of course, you can suggest a ballot title, but ultimately, the Attorney General in this case suggested a ballot title as well. How unusual is it for the Attorney General to change the ballot title this severely on an initiative?
Well, it's pretty bad. It's pretty brazen. I mean, the Attorney General, other Attorney Generals in the past have done this and it ultimately led to the outcome. But the fact that there is not just bias, but the misinformation and the not just misleading, but actually false information in the title and summary is, I think, unprecedented, which is why we felt that we have a good case, and we look forward to presenting that case further along in the courts.
Well, and you used the word bias now a couple times, and the reason why that's important is because I presume the state law in California, and I have not read it, I've read it in other states in relevant cases, but the state law presumably in California says that the ballot title must be unbiased so that the voters can get an objective description of what the ballot title would do. Is that correct, which is why you think it's important to point out the fact that the language the Attorney General chose is not neutral and is, in fact, biased against the measure itself?
That is correct. There's language in the statute essentially says that it outlays how the title and summary should be derived from the Attorney General. And it includes it has to be factual. It has to cover the chief points of the initiative. And not be prejudicial, which all three of those things that the Attorney General did with our title and summary.
Yeah. So is there a right of appeal that you still have, or are you stuck with this ballot title?
You know, we are looking to appeal. We do have that option. But, you know, when we look at the whole process, our initial deadline is May 28th. So one of our remedies we were asking for was an extension along with a title and summary change. And so we continue that process, but ultimately the Attorney General is doing everything that he can to combat us. And just to add to that, part of what adding to this case is the Attorney General is a party to lawsuits fighting various aspects of her measure in court against school districts. He's being sued by by teachers, actually, for this policy. So, you know, he can't be impartial when he's a party to all these different lawsuits.
Yeah. And presumably he's not claiming to be impartial. These are clearly not the behaviors or decisions of people who have any pretense of partiality. But why is it that you think, and this is just kind of a broader question about this subject, that when you promote something to allow, for example, parents to be informed and then also protect kids from irreversible harm they might do to themselves just in ignorance, why is that always framed by the left as a restriction of transgender youth, their rights of transgender youth as they frame it in this case?
Well, I think as many of your listeners know, and the Attorney General knows, and we know, that language can influence people's decisions. And so you have to take something that's negative and say it in a positive light, or take something that's positive and say it in a negative light if that's your position, right? You're trying to defend your position. So that's what the Attorney General is doing here. And this is why, to answer your question, why the left uses language to support their cause, even if that's not factually happening for the issue.
We only have about 30 seconds left for this, but assuming the voters get a fair and accurate description of what this ballot measure is, what is the position of the public on this matter?
Yeah, so most people support this, including Democrats. If you go to our website, protectkidsca.com, you can see some polling. There's been subsequent polling, and all of it supports that. Even in California, the average voter, including Democrats, would support this measure. And so really, it's just a fringe few and happen to have control of our legislature that is driving these policies in California. But the California voters can and I do expect will change our policies if we ever can get to that.
Where can voters in California connect with your effort?
Yeah, go to protectkidsca.com. You can join our social media and sign up and learn more about our measures.
Jonathan Zacherson, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
When we come back, a group of middle school girls in West Virginia did something courageous that could be key to solving a national crisis. We'll tell you about it when we return.
Christians must be sure to faithfully think about the issues that have taken our culture and many of our churches by storm from a biblical perspective. Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book, Male and Female, He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage to help Christians better grasp the Bible's teaching about these issues. This study presents a biblical view of homosexuality, transgenderism, and marriage. With this new resource, readers will be given guidance on specific questions related to preferred pronouns, identity, intersex conditions, and other matters that our churches must be discipling their members to respond to with love and biblical conviction. As part of the study, readers have access to supplemental videos by Dr. Albert Moeller, Dr. Heath Lambert, Reverend H.B. Charles, Dr. Christopher Yuan, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, and others that expand and elaborate the themes of each chapter. To purchase a copy, go to hecreatedthem.org.
Today we find that global persecutions of Christians is growing more menacing every year. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares personal stories from those who have endured religious persecution and gives a close look at the dire situations Christians often face due to dangerous and sometimes deadly opposition to their faith. The book's true stories of persistence and faithfulness amidst crisis offer inspiration and hope. Heroic Faith also provides insights into the ideologies driving the hostility and persecution, what steps the U.S. government might take to help, and how readers can best respond to the struggles of the faithful. It is critical for us to learn from our brothers and sisters who are suffering deeply and to do whatever we can to help. You can get your copy of Heroic Faith wherever books are sold or by going to frc.org/heroicfaith. Again, that's frc.org/heroicfaith. Men are constantly told that there is no place for their thoughts and concerns about abortion. However, this attitude ignores the fact that both women and men are deeply and personally affected by abortion. Furthermore, one does not have to be a woman to know that abortion ends the life of an innocent, unborn child. Every man has a role to play in protecting unborn lives and supporting the mothers in their families and greater community, which is why FRC's Center for Human Dignity has released a resource titled A Man's Guide to Standing for Life. This resource was created to help men positively address the topic of life. This guide will equip men with phrases to utilize or avoid, as well as practical tips for helping to protect life and the expectant mother or unborn child he knows. Every man has the opportunity to be an unborn baby's hero by stepping in to support a mother and speaking up for her child's life. Get this free guide at frc.org/prolifemen to learn more about the important role men play in protecting unborn lives.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Joseph back home in for Tony today. Last week, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a West Virginia law preventing males from competing in women's sports could not be enforced against one particular male athlete. The court said that the law violated his Title IX civil rights. That's interesting because Title IX is supposed to apply to women, and he is not a woman. Now, later in the week, the athlete in question participated in a shot put event at a middle school track event. The other contestants in the event, who actually were female, refused to participate. Is that what it's going to take to solve the problem of males trying to compete with females? Joining me now to discuss it is Kim Russell. She's an independent women's forum ambassador and the former head coach for women's lacrosse at Oberlin College. Kim, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're going to talk about West Virginia a bit, but before we get there, I want to review some recent history, because last week the Biden administration released some new rules relevant to Title IX. What was your reaction to the new rules?
Oh, that they are trying to put in 1,500 pages a bunch of things to cover up what they're really trying to do. The original version of Title IX was 37 words. And the fact that the Biden administration in 1,500 pages is trying to hide that they are equating the word sex with gender identity. And so every institution in the country that accepts federal funding, which is pretty much every school, many daycare facilities, And almost every college, including private colleges that accept the FAFSA, is going to have to comply with this rule. And it's saying that men, again, will be able to take away opportunities from women. So it is not upholding Title IX at all. It is stripping away all rights that women have had for the last 52 years, including me. It's how I went to college on an athletic scholarship to play two sports at the D1 level at William & Mary, and what enabled me to do what I've done for the rest of my life, which is coach and teach. So it's really insanity because it's not speaking the truth.
Now, Kim, you mentioned the rule, but as you also mentioned, it's 1,500 pages, which means there's actually a number of rules embedded in this, a number of changes that they make. Is there one in particular that concerns you?
There's multiple, but one of them, for people who know my story, it's something that I'm very familiar with. It is about freedom of speech. And while the current education secretary tries to make it sound like everyone will be protected from sexual discrimination and sexual harassment and sexual assault, the wording of this will actually do the opposite. And basically, someone could just call you a transphobe for not using the correct pronouns, and you will have no due process, because at this point, you only have to either be thought of as saying something that is severe, which calling someone the wrong pronoun could be considered severe, or pervasive, meaning you're saying it over and over again. And so I can tell you as a coach, I've coached for over 28 years. And in the sport of lacrosse, similar to basketball, you would say, pick up your man. And I would say that to girls even, because that's the way we were taught. You have to play man to man. Don't say play woman to woman. We say play man to man. And at this point as a coach, I could be canceled again and fired just for saying that. And I wouldn't even be able to know what the charges were against me. So it's really crazy what is embedded in this new law or rule.
This new rule, which again is 1,500 pages. There's another interesting part of this that I think is just worth noting here, because Title IX was created for women. And so there was a definition of what women were and what men were. This new rule inserts gender identity as the prevailing category. But what's interesting in 1,500 pages, where there was a lot of lawyering, is that they never took the time to define what gender identity is. They just insert this term that is undefined. And it's really unusual in a legal context to not define the terms that you're using. Why do you think that is?
Fascinating. They're trying to trick us. What they are doing. They are making it sound like they are doing the right things for us, when in fact they are stripping opportunities from women and girls and being willing to put women and girls in dangerous spaces again, because they specifically speak of locker rooms and that anyone who identifies as a woman or a girl must be allowed in those locker rooms. So that to me is sexual harassment right there. And I'm waiting for more people to step up. I'm waiting for the Me Too movement. Where is it? Because we're telling girls to be silent in locker rooms when there's a fully intact male in the locker room. And basically, we're grooming them to be sexually assaulted because they're not going with their gut feeling, which is, this doesn't feel comfortable to me. So that's where we are.
Yeah. And that is a an important but obscured point in all of this is you're training young girls, you're training children to not listen to their inhibitions. You're training them that their inhibitions, their feelings of discomfort are actually forms of discrimination and judgmentalism that they need to train themselves out of. And of course, if children learn not to listen to their inhibitions and their instincts, they become targets for really terrible things. And that's one of the serious but underappreciated consequences of all this. But Kim, I want to move on in our discussion, because post the rules, we now have a decision out of the Biden administration rules, I should say. There's a decision from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals about a West Virginia case and a West Virginia law that says boys cannot compete against girls, but the court said that law could not be applied to a particular middle school student. What else can you tell us about that?
Well, what I can tell you is that middle school girls have had the courage to stand up for themselves, and five of them recently refused to compete against that male competitor. They all stood down so that he would have no one to compete against. And these girls are so courageous. And the fact that we're putting this on the shoulders of middle school girls who are already going through so much, the adults in the room to step up. And in this case, the coach did not. I have found out through Riley Gaines, who's been in contact with these girls, that they have actually been punished for stepping out. So again, where are the adults in the room protecting our girls and standing up for girls and women? Coaches, parents, administrators, you have got to fight back. You've got to stand up. Our girls are depending on us. Let's go.
And let's talk a bit more about that story. These middle school girls, who I understand was a shot put event, just refused to participate. Do you know how that came to be? Was this a spontaneous event? Was there some coordination between the girls before the event saying that this is what we're going to do?
I have not talked to them about that, and I do not know the details. My guess is that they did talk about it beforehand. So, again, their courage, I am hoping that the courage of these five young girls will set off a countrywide stance of girls saying no more. And of the adults saying, no more. We are not going to put our girls and women through this. There is a reason Title IX happened 52 years ago, and it is because it isn't fair when girls have to compete against boys at any level. There is a playing field for everyone who wants to compete. There are boys' teams, there are co-ed teams, and there are girls' and women's teams for a reason. To give opportunities, girl, middle school boy, before that meet, before this ruling, had already beaten over 100 girls. And since the ruling had beaten another 163, it's probably more than that at this point. So these opportunities are being taken away from girls every time a boy is allowed on a team and every time a boy or a man is allowed to compete on a women's team.
Kim, why do you think we don't see more efforts like this in these track events, volleyball games, swim meets where male participants end up competing against females? Why? It seems to be the rule still rather than the exception that the girls just say, that's too bad, let's go ahead and compete.
I think there's a combination of things happening here. One is the pressure to look like you are not a kind person, right? People are afraid to be called the name of a transphobe when they're not. Most of these people are so accepting of everyone and so afraid to hurt the feelings. Here's the thing. The highest form of kindness is truth and being authentic. And anyone who is a male, a biologically born male, cannot become a female. And it's just fact that we are biologically different. So by speaking the truth, that is the kindest thing you can do. It is the highest vibration of love is to speak the truth. And I, again, encourage the coaches and parents and administrators, but everyone is afraid, whether it's because they're afraid they're going to lose their job, they're afraid they're going to lose friends, they're afraid they're going to be ostracized by their teammates. Let me tell you, since I have spoken up, I have had more positive support than you can imagine from all across the political spectrum. Pretty much everyone is on the same page, with the exception of a very few.
Now, you mentioned the coach of these West Virginia middle school girls who boycotted this particular event seemed not to be supportive of the stand that they took and may have, in fact, expressed that to them in some way. What do we know about the coach and whether it's a he or she, I don't know, why he or she was not supportive of this effort and maybe where that pressure to the coach was coming from?
My guess is the pressure was coming from the administration. Again, any school activity is being federally funded. And just like anything else, money seems to talk and money scares people. Yeah. I will say again, the truth is the highest vibration, and we will be coming out on top on this. Women have rights. We need to stand for our women and girls.
Now, you are active on this issue. You're talking to people all over the country. Do you see momentum not only just the common sense position that there are boys and there are girls and it's okay to recognize those differences, but to women like these middle school girls taking these positions? And we've seen, you, Riley Gaines, of course, has done so prominently all over the country. Is there a growing sense of solidarity amongst those who are uncomfortable with this situation? Women and young girls saying, yeah, we're going to take a stand, even if it's uncomfortable, because we're not going to tolerate this anymore.
Yes, there is. And I believe that, again, the more people speak up, the more we'll have the courage to do it. Especially, I am going to call out these five very courageous middle school girls, because that gives adults courage. It gives kids their age courage. It gives high schoolers and college athletes the courage to speak up. We are also getting ready to do a rally. We will be going around the country. And this is a coalition of women's groups from across the political spectrum, from radical feminists who are very left-leaning and very liberal. We are all on the same page on this, and we are fighting this together. It includes professional athletes like Martina Navratilova. It includes multiple current and former athletes and coaches and policymakers and attorneys. Yeah. We will not back down.
And Kim, in about a minute, I'd be interested in just hearing a little bit more about your own story, because you've taken a stand, and undoubtedly there has been a price for you to pay in doing so. But you also mentioned the benefits of being courageous and saying what you know to be true despite that conflict. What have you learned personally through this process?
The best thing you can do is be authentic and speak from your heart and speak the truth. I accept everyone to be who they want to be, right? There is a place for everyone to play every sport that they want to play. There are people saying, why don't the trans athletes start their own teams? And others will say, well, there's not enough of them. Guess what? They used to say that to women. And there's actually a case about that with skiing. So look into that, right? Everyone is included. If you're a biological male right now, you can play on men's and boys teams or co-ed teams. And if you're a biological female, you can play on girls and women's teams and co-ed teams. And the other part of this is the safety aspect, not just in the locker rooms and bathrooms, but on the field. And it's, we're not just talking about from trans athletes. We're talking about from boys and men who may be playing on a women's team, because there are states that allow that. Massachusetts, we saw it this fall in field hockey. I am a field hockey player. The worst injury I've ever had is from playing co-ed field hockey as an adult. I was taking that chance, however. I knew I was playing with men, and it just happened because a man fell on me. The same injury would not have happened if a woman had fallen on me. Their force, their quickness is so much greater,
Kim,
than a woman's.
We have to let that be the final point because we are out of time, but so grateful for your courage and also for your time today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And friends, we thank you for joining this conversation. We'll be back tomorrow with more Washington Watch. Until then, fear God and nothing else.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported.
Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.